Wednesday, September 15th, was a day of work and family and an interesting encounter. In the morning, I tackled my desk. It makes you wonder if a vacation is worthwhile. And then talk with Linda and Lucy about schools and budgets and hamsters. I ate lunch with Lyndon and Marvin and Jack. And Lyndon used the occasion to give a demonstration of the trouble he was having keeping his clothes up. The belt and the last hole, the fabric of the pants, gathered up in bulging folds. He now weighs what he did when he entered the presidency. This monolithic willpower, once applied, is staggering to watch, but no fun to compete with. Obviously, he was getting fun out of his demonstration, and I could see a grin on the always correct face of Johnson the butler. In the afternoon, more work with Liz on the speeches for the American Institute of Park Executives, and later, the dedication of the horticultural domes, and then the next day, Peoria, frightens me. Suddenly, they're only 6 days away, and I'm totally unprepared and swear I won't accept any more. He called Marion McBride, mother of 6 children, newspaper reporter in Milwaukee, to find out just what the people do in those 134 parks. It's impressive that 12 million or whatever visitors do use them, but you remember it only in terms of a word picture. Mama and Papa and Susan and John spreading fried chicken and sandwiches on the picnic table after Susan and John have seen how high they can pump in the swings and fed the ducks and walk the nature trail and work with Bess on the list for the party for the dedication of the stage on September 29th. And then at 4 o'clock, a very interesting hour with Mrs. David Bruce, the wife of our ambassador to Great Britain, the most illustrious formal posts of Paris and Bonn. Katie Lockheim had called and said she was in town, Mrs. Bruce. Felt that she didn't know me very well and would like to come over for a little visit. I welcomed it. Because from afar, I've always regarded her as one of the best of us to represent America. Beautiful and young and on the best dress list always, which makes me feel quite small, but also intelligent, serious, and warm. She and Katie came. I asked Linda Bird to join us, and we had a delightful hour. I asked her if I only imagined that there was a change in the British people for the last 5 or 10 years. I seem to see it in the press, Beatles and all. Or is it an overblown phantasm? She said she thought it really was. What does it consist of? She answered, one, for the first time in many years, several centuries perhaps, the young are making themselves felt. Their tastes, their activities, and the second point she illustrated by a little story of going into a department store and saying to the very nice-looking clerk, as they call them, in his morning coat, oh, I'm sorry about the bad news that the budget must mean to many of your countrymen. It seems the new budget had imposed further taxes on beer and cigarettes and such things that meant hardships on middle-class folks. And the clerk said, yes, madam, but we don't expect good news anymore. The third and really overwhelming fact is the magnificent cohesion, the great spirit that held the British together all during the war. And then, when it was over, victory was in a way empty. Rationing. A person got one egg once a week and about one serving of meat. While the vanquished, Germany particularly, went to work rebuilding with generous help, frenetic energy and determination, somehow England stayed in a dismal fog of stalemate with no longer a great amalgam of working together toward victory and a sort of a vague virus of bitterness. Another example, she said when they were having some work done on the embassy, one day she counted 13 tea breaks. How glad I am that Lyndon was not a visitor there that day. Linda was delighted with her, and she with Linda. I am not unmindful that Linda Bird just might get to take a trip next summer to Spain and Germany and England. And this was a marvelous chance to get to know this charming woman. They said they left with joking references to your room is waiting for you. And then another round of work. And then to the bowling alley with Linda for 3 games, never beating Linda, who scored 160 one time. In the middle of it, I called Dr. Jim Kane, who just checked in as our house guest, and he came over and watched us. And then while Linda dressed up to go out for dinner and a play with John Bitar, looking beautiful, how it pleased me that her daddy should see her smartly groomed and gay. He could have taken the words right out of Thomas Jefferson's mouth about advice to young daughters when Thomas Jefferson wrote his Patsy. But nothing is so disgusting to our sex as a lack of cleanliness and grooming in yours. And you should always look, even upon arising in the morning, as carefully dressed as if it were tea time or dinner time. Lyndon brought a chance for a quiet little talk with Jim, and we discussed the alternatives that we could follow. He feels reasonably sure that it was an attack of gallbladder trouble, that we should wait 2 weeks and have further tests, but the prognosis will be for surgery, and only the date remains to be determined. He used the expression that if we do not take the gallbladder out, we are sitting on a keg of dynamite, because a repeated attack with infection, an inopportune time in some far part of the United States, or right before some crucial speech or decision, would be bad. But it behooves us to choose the time as well as one may. I want to do it right after the visit with the Pope on October 1st or 2nd, perhaps about the 5th. Lyndon and Marie came over for dinner. We had a quiet and pleasant hour. Few people in Lyndon's life are soft, ladylike, and lulling as Marie, and it will be a great loss if she leaves to be married. And of losses, today has brought us two that I feel sentimental about. That I knew they were coming does not take the edge off my regret. Buzz has left. In his letter, he said, "I can resign my desk, but not my devotion. Your great determination that our system shall successfully serve these times of change is an inspiration that makes every day too short for those working with you." And another paragraph that I'm glad he felt and said, "Mary V and I, and the children too, are grateful especially for the private opportunities to share with you and Mrs. Johnson the happiness as well as the history of these months and years. After 18 years of being with us, I just can't quite take this as permanent, but it is a blow." And then Dick Goodwin's truly magnificent letter, and one that I think represents considerable success on Lyndon's part in dealing with people and coming to understand them, to draw from them the best of service that they've got in them, and in the doing, to win a personal friendship that was not there to begin with. Dick said, "No one has ever shown greater kindness or warmth toward me." I'm particularly glad of that sentence. And then, "I'm also grateful that during our work together you have broadened my horizons to include Texas, the land and the America from which you come. Beginning in ignorance, I have ended in respect and affection, and I will always be a broader person for it. Some poetry will go out of his speeches, and I'll lose my right arm in working on the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library. Somehow we managed to go on. So many have left during the years, Mary and Walter. But it is lonesome and draining. Tonight I worked hard at my exercises. I'm determined to lose a few inches and have that feeling of being fit, in control of myself."